Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymeer Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymeer.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymeer Church of Christ.
And as we spend some time tonight, over the next few Sunday nights, we're going to take sort of a devotional journey through some places in Scripture that I hope will give us maybe a greater appreciation for some of the things that we read in the Bible. And so tonight, just as sort of an overview, I'm going to do something that you always love when people do for you, and that is show you pictures from their vacation. I mean, isn't that just what you wanted to see tonight, pictures from someone's trip? But I do think that as we go through some of these places that we were privileged to see and to be a part of on this trip to Israel, hopefully they'll make some connections for us and help us visualize some of the places that we've read about. There was a group of 21 of us that left for this 10-day trip. My mother and father sort of put together the group, and Dad led the trip, and it was a great group to be part of. Many of you who went to Fried Hardeman know the Sewells, Milton and Laurel Sewell, and they actually went on this trip as their a celebration of their 50th anniversary and had their children and all but a few of their youngest grandchildren with them. Some of the younger grandchildren chose Mid-South Youth Camp, and I can understand that. I mean, that's a lot more fun when you're that age. But it was a really neat trip to be a part of. And as we flew in, we had kind of your typical delay you would expect, about 3 or 4 hour delay through this flight. The first place that we went was Joppa. And this is a view here of, you can see the Mediterranean Sea right here. This is the view you get when you just sort of park on the side and you look out over this port. This would have been the place, as we read through Scripture, where Jonah goes to sail off to Tarshish. He goes to Joppa. In the New Testament, when Tabitha is brought back to life, is raised by Peter being there, that took place in Joppa. Obviously, as is the case with a lot of these sites you'll visit, if you were to go over there, you would see that over the years there are a lot of churches, various kinds of churches and other groups of faith, the Jews or Muslims who have taken places and made them holy sites and built some beautiful structures, some beautiful church buildings over there. And so a lot of what you'll see, you kind of have to sort through what has been tradition that's endured over the years. This is the place where this happened, or this is the place where this happened. And what can we know in Scripture? What I like about looking at a place like Joppa is that we might not know exactly where this port was, but it had to be somewhere around here. You know, you have to be pretty close. There is a large church there. This is kind of the view going up the hill when you go towards the left. And we went inside. I just thought this was a neat shot of them doing some work on these columns, some ornate columns in St. Peter's Church there. Many of the churches, church buildings there would be some Catholic church buildings as well as a lot of Eastern Orthodox churches that were there. And like I said, the structure, the structures on the inside, I mean, were just beautiful to see the work that's gone on there. And to understand that most of that was done in an effort to preserve the site. There are times you sort of wish there wasn't as much built up around a particular site, but we understand why that was done and when sort of the motives behind that. Then our first night was in a place called Netanya, and I don't know if you can see the sunset. It was beautiful there. This was definitely the most westernized place we stayed our entire time. It's a growing area. They even had, they had like an IKEA and you know, a mall with an H&M in store and everything. I mean, it was like going through a city in America. But then we got started the next day on Caesarea Maritima. Caesarea Maritima, as you can see with these columns here, was a port city. There were other settlements that were there, but this was a city that was built by Herod the Great. And you'll notice many of the places you can visit over there now were built by Herod. This took approximately 12 years for Herod to fully complete. And it was really designed to be an impressive port city and designed to impress Rome, which is why he gave it the name Caesarea. Maritima means by the sea. And so places like this, I know those of you who went to the Thursday night class or that Joel Oswalt was teaching about the 12 places, some of this will be familiar, and many of you have gone to places like this. But it's amazing to see the amount of architectural insight that was put into a place like this one. Here you can see a little bit closer the columns that have sort of been left there. Some have been kind of left and set up in the ways they think it would have looked after the time of Herod. There were other people that took over this area. It had an amphitheater. It had an arena there where you would have chariot races. As you can see, if you can see those steps right back there, that's where they would have gathered for those chariot races. It was really incredible to see the way breakers were put down to have the water come over the breakers. One guide said it was almost like Herod had built his own infinity pool. I mean, he had the water coming over like that. And one of the things that you notice, you can go right up to sort of where the harbor would have been, and you can see that that blue water over there, and just imagine how this would have been welcoming in ships from Rome. And Herod had the kind of mindset that if Rome had it, he wanted to have it too, and he really wanted to impress. One of the things that's there right here is the pilot stone, if I don't know who the guy is standing behind it, but if you just look at this, I didn't take a picture of just the pilot stone, so I apologize. But this was a stone that was discovered in 1963 that first gave concrete evidence of Pilate's existence in Judea in the time of Jesus. One of the things people would say when they'd read about Pilate is, well, we don't have any archaeological evidence that backs this up. And so this is not the actual stone itself, it's a replica of it. But this discovery here really showed the fact that, yes, Pilate did live here in this area, and that to see him going into Jerusalem during the time of the Passover would just be a natural thing to take place. And so that was a pretty neat thing, a faith-building thing to see. And then these were the aqueducts that Herod had built in order for water to come through. And I'll show you kind of the side view right here. You can see it's just an impressive structure going sort of all the way down. And you've got the coast of the Mediterranean right there. After looking at the aqueducts, we went to a place called Megiddo. And if you've thought of the term Armageddon before, you'll sort of understand where the term Armageddon comes from is based on this area, Megiddo, which was really sort of the prime battle site. There were countless battles that were fought at Megiddo. And so when we think about the term Armageddon in Scripture, it would be like if we lived in the first century and were reading about Megiddo, we would immediately think of a battle. You would immediately think of something that took place there. And so we walked up it, as you can see, some of the fortifications that were around there. And I'd like for us to see, let's see if I can get to the right picture. There we go. You can see a little bit more of the outlook and just sort of what it would be like to look out over this spot. It just looks like a place for a battle. Sort of a legend of Megiddo is that Napoleon once visited there and, you know, walked up and said, "This is a great battleground. I mean, this is where battles took place." And so it was amazing to look out over there. What was also really incredible was to go to the top of Megiddo and to just see how the whole region opens up. And so our guide could tell us about, well, here's, if you were going to Samaria, Samaria's over there, and you'd have to go through this mountain and this mountain. And it was just amazing to see from a point like that what you could see about that whole area. This is a granary that I just thought was kind of an interesting shot of how they would have stored grain then, with sort of a walkway to get down. This, if you ever go to Megiddo, just remember there are a lot of steps. Just an example, I forget how many steps it was up and down. And then we went to Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is, when we read through Scripture, the site where Elijah faces off with all of those prophets of Baal. They call on Baal. Elijah calls on God, and the God who answers with fire is the one true God, and God answers that way. Then Elijah runs down Mount Carmel. There is a church building, again, that's been established here on the side of the mountain. You don't know exactly where that happened on the mountain, but you know it was somewhere. You're on the mountain. And this is us having a devotional time before we continue going through Mount Carmel. Here's a view from Mount Carmel. It was just something to stand up there and to try to picture Elijah running down there and to imagine what could have taken place. Also here, you see these were growing on Mount Carmel and a lot of other places we went. These are carob pods, C-A-R-O-B. And it was very, very common for them to grow in that area. And from what I understand, when you're reading through Luke 15, thinking about the prodigal son, and you remember the prodigal son comes to his senses when he's standing there feeding the pigs, and he wanted to, the pods he was feeding the pigs started looking good. It seems to me these are what they would have looked like. This would have been common for them to be fed, as well as people to take those and to eat them. So it's interesting to get a visual there. Then the next day we went on the Sea of Galilee. The boat we used to take our ride on the Sea of Galilee was called King David, and my dad was really excited about that since that's his name. So he was showing that to everybody. But when we get on the boat, there's our guide, Waleed. Waleed's an interesting story. He is a member of the Greek Orthodox Church, and yet he had met people from all kinds of different faith backgrounds on his tours. And so he could give you some insight into what other faiths would believe. But here we are on the Sea of Galilee. We had a devotional here like we did a lot of other places. I was in charge of leading the devotional on the Sea of Galilee, and I'm pretty sure I can't tell you what I actually said in that devotional, because you're just looking around at the Sea of Galilee, and it didn't matter what I said, because we were all just looking around. When you keep reading in the Gospels how Jesus gets into a boat, and he goes here, and he gets into a boat, and gets here, you understand why. You're at the Sea of Galilee. It's not that large a body of water, and so you can see how, well, you just get into a boat to go over to Capernaum, or you get into a boat to go over to the Decapolis, and to the Gentile area, the Ten Cities area over there. And this was probably one of the highlights, if not the highlight for me, because if you get out into the Sea of Galilee far enough, you can look around and you don't necessarily see the modern buildings, and you just get a sense that this is what Jesus would have seen. And so it was a really neat thing to be part of. This is a boat that they discovered in, I believe, the 1980s, 70s or 80s, that is probably a good example of what a fishing boat would have looked like in Jesus' time. They had to do some really interesting things with a foam kind of substance when they found it to keep the whole boat together, because, as you can imagine, some of that was just disintegrating, and they had to sort of go through and sort of glue things together and keep that together. But it really gives us a visual when you think of Jesus and his apostles being on a boat. It probably would have come close to looking like this. And so you can imagine when a storm starts brewing, it could be pretty rough when you're in a boat that size. Then we continued and went to Caesarea Philippi. This is the place where Peter makes the good confession that Jesus is the Son of God. And Caesarea Philippi is fascinating for a lot of reasons. You may remember in Matthew 16, when Jesus takes them there, and he does that little play on words with Peter, which is from the word Petros, which, you know, means stone or rock, and he sort of says, "I'm calling you Peter." And then on this rock, Peter confessed that Jesus was the Son of God. He said, "I'm going to build my church." What's fascinating about that is, if you look at these kind of outcroppings here of rock in Caesarea Philippi, it's incredible to think about what would have been a visual for them standing there. Now, none of us were there, but I have to imagine that they would have been looking at this rock that was there, and as they discussed this. One of the other things that you notice when you go to Caesarea Philippi is it's, I believe it was a 4 days journey walking. It was a long drive to go north to Caesarea Philippi. And you wonder, why would Jesus take them there if he's going to ask this question, "Who do men say that I am?" And to get to the part where you're standing right now looking at this, you have to go by what was the ruins of one of Herod's summer palaces. I think Herod had a palace everywhere we went, but he had a summer palace there. And then you have the ruins on the side of an altar to Augustus that was there. If you look, I've got, it's hard to see, I took a picture of sort of their outline. There's that temple of Augustus. Then you have temples that developed over the years. Not all of this would have been there when Jesus was there. But you likely did have this area over here dedicated to worshiping Pan, the pagan god Pan. So you've got a palace of Herod, an altar temple to Augustus you see here. You have this Pan worship that probably had taken place for years and years beforehand, and we don't know exactly when all these structures were there, but it was associated with worship of Pan when Jesus was there. And Jesus is saying, "Who do men say that I am? Am I one of these rulers? Am I a God that you worship? Who do men say that I am?" And then when he says, "On this rock I will build my church," it just seems to come alive when you think about all these churches that were built up against this rock, these temples built up against this rock. And so that was an incredible thing to sort of see and to witness. Then we went to the Mount of Beatitudes. Again, you don't know exactly where Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount, but this gives you a view of the Sea of Galilee right here in the background. And as you're standing on the place where it's remembered that Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, you almost get a sense in this view. You can see sort of the netting here that's being done to protect some of these plants. But other than that, that view would have to be pretty close to what you would have seen if you were listening to Jesus preach the Sermon on the Mount. And we stopped for a moment and sort of talked about the Sermon on the Mount a little bit. We went through, there's my favorite sign again about the thirst and the water that's not available to drink. Then we went to Capernaum. This gives you an idea, if you've wondered what Capernaum would have been like as far as Jewish dwellings there, the dwelling places. You'd have a lot of two-room, one-room homes that were there. If you think about families that were living, you would likely have a room where you prepared food and where you ate, sort of the main area, and then a room where a family might all sleep in the same room, the same area. And so you had a lot of dwellings like these in Capernaum. There was also a synagogue that was in Capernaum, which was fascinating. You had, if you can see this sign, says the late 4th century A.D., this white stone synagogue here that was built on the remains of what they call the Synagogue of Jesus. And you can see the different colors in the stones. And so while this synagogue itself was not contemporary with Jesus, their belief is that this stone foundation is from the synagogue that was there. And just walking through a synagogue, even though you've got centuries of separation, you still get a feel for what it would have been like to walk through the synagogue and to sort of sit down on one of the seats that were along the side. These pictures are a little fuzzier because I had some sort of switch turned off on my camera that I should have turned on. So if you can see anything past the glow here of the Jordan River, what was interesting to be in the Jordan River was how murky the water was. There's a lot in Scripture about the Jordan River, but if you remember, Naaman was told by Elisha to wash in the Jordan River, and he started listing off the other rivers that were a lot cleaner. Well, you kind of get a picture of that when you look at the water itself. It's pretty murky, and I don't know if you can see this well, but they don't eat catfish in Israel. It's kind of a bottom feeder. They don't eat catfish. So when I went to put my hand in the Jordan River, I mean, I was really excited about this. The Jordan River, this is incredible. I went to put my hand and you had about 17 huge catfish that came up snapping. And so I waited until a guy came by and threw some bread and they all followed that way. And then I could actually touch the Jordan River. But those of you who like catfish, I mean, you could probably catch some pretty big ones there. They were the biggest ones I'd seen up close. When you go to the Jordan River, there'll be a lot of people there who are baptizing. They'll tell you for the right amount of money, you know, they can baptize you right where John baptized Jesus. I don't know how they know that, but they've got the spot picked out. And so it was interesting to see groups of people that were doing that while we were there as well. But it really is something just to think about everything significant that happened around the Jordan River. And I know I'm going very quickly over a lot of these, and we're going to come back to these in our series. We then went to Beit Shan, which is an ancient city, likely a city that Jesus would have walked through or come through in his travels. It also had some of the things that were pretty typical of that area. You have this amphitheater, and it was one of those deals, if you've been to an amphitheater like this, where you could stand right there and whisper and people could hear you on the top row. And so it's amazing to think about their understanding of acoustics that went there. Sunday, we worshiped with the church in Nazareth. And it was really interesting to go into Nazareth and to think about everything significant with Jesus coming from Nazareth, and that there's a group of Christians that are worshiping there. Now, most of the Christians in Nazareth are Arab Christians. And so they're going to have in their songbooks, they'll have Arabic on one side, we'll see in just a minute, and the songs on the other side in English. They are used to having tour groups come through and worship with them. Their preacher, Maurice, has a son that went to Fried Hardeman, just recently graduated, and he and his wife live in Jackson. They have a daughter that had gone to Harding and has kind of got homesick and came home and is finishing her education in Nazareth. And so they have a lot of connections with a lot of people in the States. But it was really significant, too. You don't see it here, but if you walk up, there's a sign that says, "This building is not a holy site," and something to the effect of, "It only has meaning to the Christians who meet here to worship." And you kind of wonder why you'd have a sign like that. This is obviously an area where people are always looking for holy sites to visit. I sort of thought when I first saw that, maybe they're trying to keep, you know, tourists from coming in and looking for a tour. But one of the other things that happened a few days after we had been there, we visited, one of the churches we visited was the Church of the Multiplication that was built on the site where they remember Jesus feeding the 5,000. And I think it was 2 or 3 days after we had been there, there was a sort of a group of Jewish radicals, I guess, that came in at night and set fire to the roof of it and did a lot of damage. And so you have in the church there, they're also wanting to say, this is not a holy site. You know, we don't come in here to cause any damage. This is just where we meet to worship. And I thought that was significant and something to think about. This is the songbook that I mentioned earlier. This, as you can see, when the roll is called Up Yonder, I tried to find a song I thought we would all kind of know and just get a sense of what it was like to look at it on this side, Arabic on this side. Like Hebrew, Arabic goes from right to left, and so the songbook actually opened the opposite way of the way we would usually open the songbook. And so it was kind of interesting, all of us, when we wanted to put the songbook back in the rack, we all put it in backwards because that's what we're used to, and you had to turn that over. It was really neat. After we were done worshiping, they asked us to sing a song for them because, as Maurice said, we want to hear some four-part harmony. And so we sang a song for them. They gave us, they had some refreshments outside. They were very hospitable. It was a really neat part of the trip just to connect with the Christians there. This is our group, all of us except my dad, who was taking all the pictures, and I'm pretty sure he did that on purpose, so he's not necessarily in the pictures. But you have our group that was there before worship. And then we went to Jericho. Jericho is still being excavated. You kind of get a sense, and I don't know if this picture can show sort of the background, the stark contrast between Jericho and sort of the desert area around there. Jericho is not necessarily this incredible oasis, but it had a lot of green trees, had a lot of plants. You can see why it would be a place you would want to go. They're still doing a lot of digging, and I did notice these arrows around there, which I just thought was great. When the Israelites were marching around Jericho, if they needed to know which way to go, you've got these arrows they've uncovered, and so that was helpful. I also did a lot of deep study on this trip, so we went to the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea has a high enough salt content that you can just sort of kick back and float there, and so I was just doing some deep reading in the Dead Sea. It's really something to go to the Dead Sea because it's receding. And they have marks as you're driving down the highway. You can see a mark on the side of the highway where the Dead Sea was 100 years ago. And it's over here, and that mark, I believe, was like 12 or 13 feet in the air on this rock on the side of the highway you're traveling. And then you look, and the Dead Sea is very low. It's evaporating. The tributaries that come into the Dead Sea are part of the ongoing fight for clean water, fresh water. Our guide told us, he said, that the wars in the Holy Lands, he said, if we have a war, it won't be over oil, it'll be over access to water, to fresh water. And so, because people are cutting into that, nothing's flowing into the Dead Sea. And so it could be in a matter of not too long that the Dead Sea actually dries up. There are a lot of people working on ways to keep that from happening, but it's just it's interesting to see that progression. This is at Masada, a fortress built by Herod the Great. This is where, after the temple was destroyed, there were several Jews, about 300 Jews in AD 70, that took over Masada and occupied it. There was enough food and water there that they lived there for 3 years, and the Romans could not get to them because it was so high up. I'll show you this kind of the interior of the room, and this is the three-tiered palace. You can see one level, two levels, three levels there. But if you look at the view from Masada, you can see how you could see anybody coming. It was almost impenetrable. And so finally, what the Romans did as a battle plan was they built these walls, these siege walls, up against Masada that they could come in and attack the city. And it didn't make sense to me that the Jews there would allow that to happen. I mean, couldn't you just pelt them with rocks? Couldn't you be throwing things at them as they tried to build those walls? But what the Romans did was take Jewish prisoners and force Jewish prisoners to build the siege walls. And so none of the Jews were going to attack their fellow Jews who were building these walls against their will. And so it's really a tragic story that takes place there. The Jews there decided that they would rather take their own lives than to be taken by the Romans. And so there were 10 men who sort of, in a way, drew straws to see who would be in charge of making that happen. And so you have just this tragic scene at Masada. It is an incredible view to look out and just to imagine the battle that would have taken place there. Then we went to En Gedi. You've got this waterfall sort of in the middle of desert. And you may remember En Gedi from David hiding from Saul. And when Saul goes after David, I believe it's 1 Samuel 24, and Saul goes into a cave. And you can see, I think in this picture better, you can see some of these caves up here. I mean, you could just imagine David being in a cave and Saul not seeing him, and David cutting off that piece of his robe, and just sort of visualizing that was incredible. If you've heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the manuscripts that were discovered, this is the cave where the first of them was discovered. It was amazing to see some of those fragments in the Jerusalem Museum, the earliest, some of the earliest manuscripts we have of the Old Testament, of every book there, but Esther is, as we see that discovery. We also had something interesting I took a picture of, and this is a mikveh. This is a ritual bath area. The people who lived in Qumran, the group called the Essenes, were very concerned with purity. And so they'd have these ritual baths. And I showed this picture because there were several of these around the temple in Jerusalem. And it seems likely that when thousands of people are baptized, those are what were used to baptize them. You had these mikvahs that were already there. One of the things that shocked me more than anything else was when we were driving down the road and a guide said, "Well, this is the Mount of Olives." And I said, "Where's the Mount of Olives?" He said, "Well, we're driving on it." You know, in our minds, we sort of think of it as being separate and sort of in Bible times, but this is a road where people have to make a living. And so if you could look at all the languages there, you get a sense of how many other countries and cultures were there. You'd hear people speaking Spanish and Russian and all kinds of different languages as they were going through on their tour groups. Here's a picture of Jerusalem and sort of the Dome of the Rock there that's on the Temple Mount. Closer up picture is right here. The Temple Mount area, where although they don't know exactly where the temple was, they have the Temple Mount and know where the temple would have been before it was destroyed, was taken over centuries ago by the Muslims. They've laid claim to the Temple Mount. And so you have three different groups, the Jews, Christians, and Muslims, that are all visiting this area, all for different reasons. This is the Dome of the Rock, a mosque that was built on the Temple Mount. There are also several smaller, what they would call mosques, smaller structures, all over the Temple Mount. and they place those there, so if anybody comes in and decides they're going to forcibly build another temple, they'll have to take down one of those mosques, and they don't want to do that. And so it's a really, the tension there is very interesting. When we went through the Temple Mount, even the area around here, one of our ladies had a necklace with a cross on it, and one of the men who was sort of the gatekeeper of that area was talking to her about it and talked to our guide, and they worked something out, and she sort of covered up her cross and sort of moved it around where it was covered up by her shirt. And I asked the guide what he had said, and the guide said, well, he told me you can't wear that cross, and he said, it's okay, we'll hide it. And the guy said, well, you need to take that off and throw it away. Get it out of my sight. Well, that was an example of a Muslim man letting us know what he thought about the cross. And it sort of gave you just an insight into this idea of the cross being something that would have been shameful for some in the first century, and that wouldn't have made any sense. And so you get a sense of that discussion. This is blurry, but I really like this picture. When we went to the Church of the Nativity, we passed the KFC. And I just thought that was great. The Church of the Nativity is in Bethlehem, so this is the Bethlehem KFC. And if you're going to see where they celebrate the birth of Jesus, I just love the idea that someone would say, how do you get to the Church of Nativity? Well, you go to KFC and you take a right. I just think that's great. So they went to KFC, and then we walked past that. This is, if you were to go into the church they've built there in Bethlehem to honor the birth of Jesus, again, they'll tell you this is right where it happened, and understand that tradition has built up a lot of that. But I thought this was interesting, and again, it's under sort of a grotto area, they call it right here. There's a shadow, it's hard to get a good shot, but this is the star that they sort of place on the point where they believe that the birth took place. It's 14 points in the star. Those are representative of generations, 14 generations from Abraham to David, from David to the Israelites in exile, and from the exile to Jesus. And so you get a sense of that and some of that understanding. This was probably one of the most crowded places we went to. Here is a picture I just sort of took of the city of Bethlehem. I don't know if you can see over here. This is St. John's souvenir stand. After he wrote the gospel, you probably didn't know that he also had a souvenir stand. John the Baptist had a souvenir stand too there, apparently. I bring that up just to say it is interesting to see some of the commercialization that's there. And so you have people that grow up in the Holy Lands, but their knowledge of Jesus is connected with commercialism. And so you have, for instance, a guy in Jerusalem who was walking around with a donkey for donkey rides, and he said, you can ride the Jesus taxi. That's what he called it, the Jesus taxi. I thought, that's how he views that. How am I making money? And so it's kind of interesting to see that. And one of Israel's probably the main income that they have is tourism. And you really see that when you go over there. And so they do want to take care of you. People have asked if I felt safe going over there. I will say that doing what we did, I felt very safe. We were always on a tour bus at a hotel or at one of these biblical sites where they want to keep tourists coming, and they want to keep that money coming in. And so those were all very regulated. We felt safe the entire time. Obviously, you're in a city in Jerusalem, but it was a good experience, and really a lot different than what I expected because they've made things so easy for tourists. This is the area right after we went there. We went to the Herodium, and I've mentioned that a couple of weeks ago. This is where Herod had built this tomb he was going to be buried in. And it was also the place where he was going to have Jewish nobles on the day of his funeral. He was going to have his men take Jewish nobles in and put them to death so there he could be sure there'd be mourning on the day of his funeral. He was afraid the Jews wouldn't mourn him. Now, when he died, history tells us his men didn't carry out that order. They sort of came to their senses and didn't carry that out. But that gives you a little insight into Herod and sort of what was going on in his mind as some of those things were happening. One of the places we went was the Garden Tomb. This is one of the sites, the proposed sites for Golgotha, the place of the skull. And you can sort of see where they've found features of this rock that they think looked like a skull. Again, it's helpful as a visual. You know, we can't know with accuracy these places, but We saw that as a visual, and then the garden tomb was, I think, a really powerful visual of what a tomb would have looked like in that time. We don't know what tomb it was, but the garden tomb, what it has in common with Jesus' tomb, is that they're empty. And so this is an empty tomb. So this gives you a sense of what that looked like. You can go in, and I know this is hard to see. You can see on one side where the body would have been placed, on another side where it would have been prepared. If you think about the spices and the grave clothes that would have been used there. This is a model of the city of Jerusalem, and took a lot of pictures of this. It's a great visual. It's there at the museum. It's a great visual of what it would have looked like during the time of Jesus. This is just sort of an overview of the city itself. When we stopped to get our group picture in front of that, and of course we hadn't been there long, and then we had a guy come over with a camel ride, and so a few of us had to get a picture on a camel. I think that's one of the things you're supposed to do when you're over there. But this is one of our other most powerful times. This is in the Garden of Gethsemane, a section of it. They have a section you can see from the street, and then a section of it that's sort of been fenced off. Our group had 40 minutes there of quiet time in Gethsemane. This is an olive tree that you would see there. And again, it's not a garden in what we would normally think of as bright flowers. But this really sort of gives us, I think, a pretty good visual of what Gethsemane would have looked like. As we walked through the Kidron Valley, you have these tombs that are built in there, these historic tombs that have been built over the years. And then as you continue sort of journeying through Jerusalem, we went to the Western Wall. And this is a sign I thought was interesting. If you're going to what we normally call the Wailing Wall, they don't like you to call it that. They like you to call it the Western Wall. This is the one wall of the temple complex, not of the temple itself, but of the temple complex that the Jews have. And so the Muslims have on the Temple Mount. They come to the Western Wall. And so you can see that the rabbis of Israel ruled that walking through the metal detector does not violate anything that would happen on a Sabbath or festivals. And I thought that was really fascinating to see that they're answering those same kinds of questions. In Jesus' day, they were saying, well, how long is a Sabbath day's journey? What is considered work? They're still answering those questions in that. And so we went to, as you can see there, the Wailing Wall. We were in Jerusalem. One of the days we were there was a bar mitzvah day, where you'd have boys being presented to the rabbis as men. You had a lot of bar mitzvah parties that were going on. And so they'd kind of be like parades. And so one would parade through, and then another would parade through. And so it was really fascinating to see all that taking place. This is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is another place in which they think you would have Golgotha, and you would have the place where Jesus was buried. And so they built a church building over that area. And you kind of go through and see some of those proposed sites. These are just the streets of Jerusalem walking through, just to give you a sense of the area. And here's an overview we took sort of on our last night that we were there. I show you all of these pictures, hopefully to give you a preview of what we're going to be doing on Sunday nights, but also just to give us a sense of the fact that what we read about in Scripture really happened. It really took place. That there were real people who really lived there, and that Jesus really did something in Jerusalem. One of the most powerful points in the Gospel, I think, we read in Luke 9, verse 51, when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And then in verse 53, the people did not receive him in Samaria because his face was set toward Jerusalem. I love that imagery of Jesus setting his face toward Jerusalem, because it's a reminder that he knew what his mission was, and there came to a point when the timing was right and he was setting his face toward it. What's also interesting to me is to know that what he accomplished in Jerusalem means that we no longer have to go to a temple mount. We don't have to go to a holy, quote, holy place to connect with God because of what Jesus did. The temple was the place where God dwelt with his people. Jesus, coming on earth and making his sacrifice and being raised from the dead, allows God to dwell within us. And that's incredibly powerful. And I thought about all the conflict that's taken place over things in the temple, over things in the temple area, and over Jerusalem. And you just want to tell people that this is not where you have to be now to connect with God, but God's made it available to all of us. And so while I realize this has been kind of a travel log, not necessarily a traditional sermon, I do want us to end with the time we always end with, an opportunity to respond to the invitation from the one who set his face toward Jerusalem and who died for us. If you'd like to become a child of God, to put Christ on in baptism, or if there's any way we can pray for you, please let us know as we stand and as we sing together.